I want a companion that will be a long-term companion for a particular user that will know all about their lives, know their photographs, know where they've been, know how they spent their life, will chat with them, will get to know things that their nearest and dearest may not get to know.
Could your best friend be a robot? The answer to this question and more on this week's Radio Berkman. It sounds like the stuff of movies and graphic novels. Robots side by side with humans, operating as fully functional and responsive servants to our needs. But the engineers behind the Companions Project have embarked on a massive international project to make embodied conversational agents. They avoid the term robots in comparisons to science fiction. A utility in everyday life. These digital companions are thought of as natural extensions of the web. Instead of turning your typed query for pizza places in Boston into a basic search of Google, a digital companion might hear you say, "I want pizza," and be able to find a pizza place nearby that is open at that time, is within your meager budget, can deliver fast since it sounds like you're really hungry, and has just that special kind of pizza you like. You know, the one with sardines, pickled garlic, and mashed sweet potatoes that no one else in the world likes. So it's definitely more than a device to search the web. It's a machine that can hear your voice, understand what you're saying, understand the meaning of what you are saying, and help you organize your digital life. One researcher, Yorick Wilkes, a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of Sheffield in the UK, is looking into applications for digital companions beyond just helping you with everyday wants and needs. Something that might become a device that truly understands you, that can be a vessel for your thoughts, ideas, and memories, and a true and loyal friend, which you'll really need if you keep eating pizza with sardines, garlic, and sweet potatoes. How and when could digital companions start appearing in our lives? We sat down with Yorick to find out. Tell me what a digital companion is.
A digital companion is fundamentally a computational agent, which is not a robot. It could be, but not a robot, but something we can think of as something that will talk to you, know about you, and sit between you and something like the internet. That's the easiest way to think of it. A different kind of conversational internet agent.
Describe what the relationship is like.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of human-computer dialogues going on everywhere. I mean, I haven't traveled an American train the last few weeks, but in most countries in Europe, you can have a very satisfactory train ticket buying experience on the phone with an automaton. It's successful. It's non-trivial. It nearly always gets you the right ticket at the right price. In Britain, we have, say, 400 rail stations, and it has to be able to distinguish those accurately, which is absolutely non-trivial because some sound similar. So, I mean, from a speech recognition point of view, that is quite a success because it's not trained to particular speakers. Anybody can get on the phone and order a rail ticket. Anybody, man, woman, child. So the fact you can have a successful human-computer interaction which gets you a rail ticket within 3 minutes without having to stand at a ticket desk is successful. It's a very trivial example, but it's a very clear one, and that's been in existence for 10 years.
But what you're talking about is something a little bit more of a sophisticated interaction.
Yeah, I only said that to say, well, you may take that as ground zero. That's base level. There really are human-computer interactions out there with conversation, with voice, with dialogue, whatever you call it, that really do work. Of course, we want more than that. I'm revealing my own interests now. I want a companion that will be a long-term companion for a particular user, presumably understanding that person's voice particularly, that will know all about their lives, know their photographs, know where they've been, know how they spent their life, will chat with them, will get to know things that their nearest and dearest may not get to know. May I give one example? I realised when my mother was dead about 5 years ago, my God, I never asked her where she met my father. I know she was 17 and he was 27, so it must have been quite interesting. She was still at school. I never asked her. Oh, no, it's too late. I can't ask her now. I've no relatives I can ask. But a long-term companion talking, when it will, talk to people for long periods, sitting on the sofa, as it were, I think it will elicit all kinds of facts about people's history and lives that their nearest and dearest will want to know later, but have never asked.
How does that work? I can imagine how it would work you know, in a relationship way. If I've got anybody sitting next to me, we can talk and we can have an exchange of ideas, and they can learn about me. I can learn about them. How does it work behind the scenes?
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, there's always a difference between the technology and the fantasy. I mean, more and more people, and a friend of mine called David Levy has just published a book called Love, Sex and Robots, where he, on the basis of some evidence, he's not a practitioner, on the basis of evidence, has said people already have relationships with very simple machines. There's lots of evidence for that. I mean, Reeves and Nass years ago showed that people think their PCs have feelings. They don't think that if you ask them, but if you look at their behavior, I won't bore you with the experiment, but anybody looks up Reeves and Nass on the web, you'll see they showed years ago that people are more unwilling to criticize their own PC on their PC than to criticize its software on another PC. In other words, it's almost as if subconsciously they think their PC has feelings. That's not totally serious, but it's a very stunning result. So, and Tamagotchi, we all know, was a huge success. So there's no doubt that people are willing to have effective relations, emotional relations of a low order with any kind of computer. So the bar is very low here. The level's very low. People act like that. We're, of course, aiming for something much higher. But you asked me about technical things, and I didn't answer.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of different ways it could go. What kinds of systems are you looking at for the technological basis for this?
There's not one school of thought about how to do it. I mean, the train systems have been done by technologists in railway companies. That works. MIT, just down the road, has spent 20 years with their airline reservation system, and it's pretty damn good, better than the railway systems. It's never been deployed, but they've got better speech recognition, better reasoning. There's lots of parts of such a system. The first thing, it's got to actually decode your speech. Decode your speech, you might think of it into writing, so it can then process the text. And that alone is a separate technology which has been very successful in the last 20 years. I mean, you know, speech recognition is now pretty good. For $100, $200, you can buy a system and install it in your PC. And you can just talk to your laptop now and you don't have to type anymore. It will take what you say and type it out in a file. But that's just the front end. I mean, you mean more than that, right?
Yeah, yeah. What is going on with that? When you're talking on the to your digital companion, when the digital companion is hearing your words, I use the word hearing as if it is hearing, as if it is a human being. So school me. Tell me what's going on.
Well, there. I mean, I was not trying to not answer. I was just trying to say that the job of getting a computer to understand you when you talk to it and know what to say back to you. That's the key bit. What's to say back, even when it's understood, has to be broken down into lots of bits. And these are lots of bits of technology that have been built up separately, usually by different teams of people. So I focused first there on what we call automatic speech recognition, ASR, it's usually called, which has made huge leaps. But of course, that doesn't do the job because that takes your speech waveform and produces a printed, typed, or an electronic file, which is text. But that doesn't tell it what the text means. You've got to then move on. My own work has not been in speech. It's been in understanding written text. So once we've got the ASR, people like me come into play. And the first thing we want to do is to break that incoming text up and try and get out of it the message in it, and what it is you want when you say it. And they're a bit different. They're a bit different when you see. I mean, you know, to use a bit of old linguistic scholarship, I mean, if I say it's cold in here, the message is clear. The message says it's cold in here. But someone who says it's cold in here isn't trying to tell you a fact about the room. They're trying to get you to turn the fire on or close the window. I mean, somebody, if I say to you it's cold in here, I'm asking you, please, if it's your house, to do something about it. So what I mean is, that's a very important thing from linguistics. I mean, the fact somebody says a fact to you, mm-hmm. and you can get that message, you're not supposed to answer, so what? You're supposed to catch on the, okay, I'll close the window. In other words, somebody who says that wants you to do something. So in linguistic terms, there's a huge gap. There's a huge, not huge, but there's a gap between what message something conveys and what the intention is of the speaker. And if a computer's to have a dialogue with you, it's got to get both of those.
It sounds like something that could be particularly difficult to overcome, because we've got human beings who, people diagnosed with Asperger's or autism, who can't even get the distinction between what is said and what is meant.
Absolutely. I mean, yes, it's good there to point to what normally thought of as, you know, psychiatric conditions of various sorts or brain conditions of various sorts, because once one of those things goes wrong in a person, you see how difficult it all is. And when one hears an autistic person who finds it hard to realize that there are other people, I mean, that's extraordinary fact when you find out about it, isn't it? I mean, you think you couldn't fail to spot that things that look like me are roughly like me, but no, some people don't spot it, and that's absolutely right. And computers in that sense are, well, they're beyond autistic. I mean, without the program, they would do nothing. What's surprising is that we have come as far as we have in speech recognition, in getting the message out of what's said to it, of making a decent guess at what it is it wants me to do. and so on. I mean, all those individual stages have in some sense been tackled. They're not the core of the problem. Beyond that is another core of a problem, which I could say something about if you want, but I mean, those are just stages in the computational linguistic struggle.
So you've taken me from when the person tells the computer something, how the computer interprets that from speech. And now we're getting to the stage of how the computer understands what is said versus what is meant. What is the next stage after that?
Even if the computer understands what you said and what you want, what should it do? The quick answer is it should do whatever you want, but that's too simple. It may have other constraints that stop it doing what you want. I mean, you know, if your companion's next to you at the edge of a cliff and you say, throw me over, I mean, it shouldn't. You know what I mean? Go out and buy me a couple of keys. I mean, you know, it's you may have constraints that stop it doing exactly that. So the dialogue manager has to interpret what you say on the basis of what you've said already, what it knows about you, what it thinks you're saying now. And then it has to, based on all it knows, it has to make a decision what to do. To do what you want, to say, yes, that's nice, thank you for telling me that. I mean, there's an infinite range of things it could do, but they've got to be somehow accessible. And the dialogue manager is the computational structure that decides that.
It sounds like we're venturing into a territory of, well, of course, one of your specialties is in artificial intelligence. But
in some sense, all I've said is artificial intelligence. I mean, just go back to the stupid machine in the station that sells you the rail ticket. I mean, it's not magic. It has to decide what to do. But in its case, it's simple. If it can find out where you want to go, what the price is, and you fit the right, as it were, passenger category, it just sells it to you. And your credit card checks out. It has to do all that. It just sells it to you. I mean, in a way, everything we've just said is present even in the stupid system that sells your rail ticket. Everything above that is, of course, more difficult, but not infinitely difficult. I mean, children learn how to deal with these things. You don't, I think, have to have a soul to go from selling a rail ticket to telling someone a joke. You know what I mean? The companion we've built also tells you jokes. you can say, tell me a joke. Read me the news. Yeah. I wanted those things built in because they use web services, and things that use web services are intellectually thin but impressive, because if you say to it, read me the news, it'll say, sure, and then it'll start reading you the news, because that's easy. All it has to do is access the web, find what the current headlines are, and start reading it on what's called text-to-speech. And all those bits are very straightforward, but it sounds impressive because it sounds like it's got a very big vocabulary. It starts saying Bush and Ahmadinejad and, you know, and Obama, and you think, my God, this thing knows about a lot. It doesn't know anything. It's simply reading the news to you, simply telling you a joke off the web. You know, the web's full of joke lists, most of which are obscene, so we have to be a bit careful what joke list it goes to, but it can tell you jokes as long as you like.
Well, when you put it in that light, that it's connected to the web, it takes it away from the companion or computer knowing, particularly knowing something as a machine, versus just having access to a wealth of knowledge, and the web in particular is a wealth of human knowledge.
I see that as more seamless than you're saying. I mean, one of the things that I would like to emphasize is that one of the failings of old artificial intelligence, and everybody knew this who thought it, read about it for at all, and its critics said this often, was that it was utterly limited and fake, because, you know, if it knew the names of six cities, say that they were the cities, you know, that the companion I've talked about is one that looks at photographs with you, and you can tell it what city that was taken in and when, what date, and who's in the picture, right? That's the background I'm thinking of in my companion. The web demo we have is of a thing that talks about your photographs, right? So if you had six cities there, a critic says, well, that's stupid. It just knows about those six cities. I mean, that's not knowing. But what we've got is that by being able to go to Wikipedia, which is essentially infinite for the point of our argument. It isn't infinite. It's been put in by people. But it breaks out of this thing of, I know six cities, because Wikipedia knows about more cities than any of us do. It knows about towns in Florida with 2,000 people. I looked one up the other day. You know, I mean, it really does. So you can say anything and it'll make a apparently sensible remark about that city as if it knew. I don't think that's cheating. I think that's just using the web in the way that an intelligent interface should use it. That's what we'd want it to do for us. It's not cheating. It's expanding its knowledge out as a form of web service. Exactly what we'd want. And, of course, it's enormous aid to computer dialogue, because it gives it the illusion, something of the illusion of breadth and personality that you do have. I mean, for example, I don't need to show it all my photographs from the start. It goes to my Facebook account and looks at the photographs of my relatives, which are tagged. So it knows already what my relatives and friends look like. So when it sees the photos, it already knows. I think it's a seamless interaction of knowledge and the language.
One thing that's that is interesting is how you put this technology on a spectrum. It's easy to listen to this and hear it and say, this is something that's so futuristic. I mean, I can't imagine interacting with it. But you've said that this interaction is just an analogy to our current obsession with the iPhone, or our current obsession with the desktop PC, or 50 years ago, what they predicted was a picture you showed was of a huge personal computer with a little a steering wheel to operate it.
As big as a house, nearly.
Yeah. I think what I'm trying to ask is, I want to hear you articulate how you view this as how it might be adopted in society.
Well, okay, that's good. I mean, it's difficult to generalize about the speed of scientific prediction. I mean, you refer to that famous slide from the RAND Corporation I showed of what they thought the personal computer would look like in 2000, what they thought in 54, and it's to say it was the size of a house and had a steering wheel. I mean, how wrong they were. But often, if you look at the history of scientific prediction, I think the generalization is that people have been, in general, too conservative. Things have moved faster than they thought. I think companion-like things are coming into being, that they're not science fiction. I mean, my grandparents presumably would have been stunned to think you could pick up, they knew about phones, not that old, but I mean, they'd have been stunned to think you could pick up a phone and order a rail ticket by talking to a machine. We now think that's trivial. I'm taking that as the lowest base case. But my grandparents would have thought that was magic. They couldn't believe it. How does it do it? How does it know the names of the stations? How does it know the prices? So, I mean, again, one's astonishment moves, doesn't it? So the stuff I'm talking about, I didn't mean to be talking science fiction language. I think what we're talking about, much of it will be there within a decade or two, and people will like it, but I can't prove that now.
I think it's interesting to think about it in terms of science fiction, because that's the most ready analogy a lot of people have for it when they see a movie and they see these gadgets being used. You know, it in a lot of cases, science fiction movies have offered the prototype for the devices that are manufactured, and also given people made people ready to understand them and get used to them.
I think you're so right. I mean, Dick Tracy had a radio watch, didn't he? And everybody remembers HAL, which was the non-cooperative philosophical computer that had its own view of what should be done with a bomb. I mean, and we didn't. The people in the film didn't like what it thought, but that's a risk. Yes, this is the downside of science fiction, is it? It causes some people to think these things are already here. And I'm not a science fiction fan, but it's so good it's there, both warning and encouraging us as to what's to come. In this area, I don't think much of what I was talking about in the lecture and the kinds of companions I can see that would move from the ticket seller to the kind of companion I showed you that already talks quite sensibly but in a fairly boring way about your pictures. I don't think the leap to something that is able to keep up a longish conversation and reminiscence with you over a period is too far away. I mean, okay, maybe it's 30 years, but we have come an awful long way.
What are some of the kind of cautions that have come up in your research, the kind of maybe trust issues or privacy issues, things like that?
To have a companion of the sorts I'm envisaging in 20, 30 years that can have a long conversation with you over a long period, there'll have to be a lot more machine learning in there. We couldn't hand code all that. But to jump forward to the last thing you asked, it's very important. I mean, even though we don't have them now, and what we've got on the web, some people would say is trivial, although I think it's quite fun, we can already discuss what the cautions are. I mean, if this companion over 20 years talking to me, as I slowly slip into dementia and it has to remind me who my children are and what their names are and where I live. That's possible. It may have to remind me what my phone number is as we get older and sillier, but it will know so much about me that alone makes people very cautious. People are very worried already that medical systems know all their medical facts. We know, I'm not personally worried about them least. I don't see the problem, but I know from the public press that a huge number of people are really worried that there is a computer that knows all their medical facts. So just think how much worse that's going to be when here's a computer in my living room that knows everything about my past sex life, my medical life, everything about me, what I think about my nearest and dearest, which I wouldn't dare say to their faces. This is a very dangerous thing, and there will be huge... There'll have to be some kind of constraints on what that can do and what people can do with it and who can have access to it.
Perhaps those constraints and the cautions that we think about right now might not be the same in 30 years' time when these devices become more integrated in our lives. I'm thinking a lot about Facebook and Twitter right now, these social utilities that have opened up our lives.
That's absolutely right. There's no fixed level here. I mean, I'd say three teenage daughters, but they're around teenage. But their attitude to public private information is completely different from mine. Actually, I don't care much about private information, but most people. Most older people like me have very strong views on private information. But we all know that teenagers put up the most amazing things that their parents think. And you're quite right. They've simply changed the level of what is acceptable. It's like, you know, I was brought up to believe that the Dutch had no net curtains in their windows. But you could see into their houses because they didn't care if people saw what went on in their houses because nothing wrong went on there anyway, so they didn't care. And the English, like me, I mean, thought that was terrible. Of course you have net curtains. You don't have people looking in. And it's a bit like that. I mean, different cultures have different attitudes to being watched.
And one other caution that sort of came to mind when we were talking earlier was about just the relationship that you have with a machine. And when I think of a relationship, I think of a kind of a transaction of trust that you're letting some of your guard down in exchange for another being to let their guard down a little bit. You're having a transactional experience there. And that might not be the same for a human and a machine.
That's a very deep point. I mean, I think I may have mentioned earlier that David Levy, an old friend of mine, has just published his book called Love and Sex and Robots. And he's put out a very interesting and well-argued case that humans will have affectionate relationships with artificial beings soon. And in some sense, they already do. They like their Tamagotchis. In Japan, there are old people who love their chattering rag dolls. I mean, these things are already there. David Levy thinks that this is going to become quite normal for a culture of, like we're getting, of lonely older people and isolated people and so on. And this will be necessary for them and will do them good, just like pets do them good and people live long with pets. But you're quite right. What you just said, of course, is cuts against that because I could trust my computer to keep my secrets because I'd set up rules so it wouldn't tell anyone. But it's got nothing to reveal to me, and that... I could say, you could say to David Levy, what's wrong with what you're saying is that it isn't another person. It has nothing to tell me. I can feel as affectionate as I like about it, but it's got nothing to tell me. I suppose the analogy there is dogs, cats. I mean, people have emotional relationship with their dogs, but in some sense, the dog has nothing to reveal. However, the dog does give, doesn't it? I mean, there's a special doggy look and a pat with the paw and a lick. You could say the dog does have something to give. But whatever the dog has to give, it isn't the same as what I've got to give. And that's the point I want to make, yes. The dog-human affectionate relationship is asymmetric. So I suspect the human-computer relation will always have to be asymmetric.
I guess it would have to be a bigger sociological question about what effect does having a relationship with a computer compared to having a relationship with another human being or another or an animal, for that matter.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's going to be a lot of exploration of that. I mean, we can all see it could be pathological. It could be fetishistic. It could be weird. I mean, I could imagine seeing a movie of someone with a relationship with their computer. And, well, there are such movies already. Westworld is the famous one. But, I mean, we just wouldn't like it. We'd think that anybody who did that was not a normal person. I mean, you know, plastic dolls are not... fashionable, you know, there people buy them, but most people think, ugh, I don't think that's the best you could do, you know what I mean? And yet again, people may change their standards. I'm not a salesman for David Levy's point of view. He's interesting to me, partly he's a good friend of mine, but partly because he's created some public stir on chat shows with this book, and he's made people think about the possibilities. You know, some people I know are embarrassed to say how much they devoted their dogs. You know, they have operations on them at the veterinary surgeon, and they bury them with some pomp when they die. I mean, I think that's absurd, but people differ.
Well, I do have one last question for you, we were talking about the natural language processing a little bit, and I know that's one way of kind of having a human-computer interaction that bridges that gap. But I know there's been a lot of other research going on into different ways to interact. The furthest example that I can think of with between the mind and a machine. Do you see any possibility for that kind of interaction?
Well, I mean, yeah, you're opening up a whole area. We need another program. But of course, there's been some publicity lately in the papers about could there be mind-to-computer direct control? Usually it's causing little bouncing balls, or it's usually causing screen lights or balls to move, isn't it, without actually touching the keyboard. I'm not yet convinced that those experiments really work, or they're better than random, but people who know more than I do assure me they are better than random, just like, you know, telekinesis and various forms of parapsychological experiments were always better than random. There are always people who know better than random what cards will come up, so I'm not really a skeptic. I'm an empiricist. I'll be convinced by the evidence. Sure, there's all kinds of extraordinary possibilities. I mean, ranging from the sublime to the ridiculous. I said earlier that I'm in the language processing business, but lots of the people I meet but are not my gang are people who think that's absurd, that our basic relations with people, animals, machines should be emotional. And the language is secondary. They believe language is only just a poor vehicle for emotion. I think it's okay. I like it that way. I believe in poetry, blah, and you know, love songs. But a lot of people think emotion is something deeper than language, that dogs have emotion but no language, so that you can relate to creatures like dogs directly with emotion without language. So why shouldn't you relate to computers directly with emotion? I find that hard to grasp, but it's a position I understand and could turn out to be right. I think I am locked into the language mode and believe language is our supreme, you know, I sound like I'm agreeing with Noam Chomsky. I don't mean to do that, but never do that. But in some sense, I guess I'm, like a lot of academics, locked at the language level. But not everybody is.
And it's something that served us so well for, you know, millennia. It's hard to imagine another system. But once you break through that barrier of thinking that language is the only way we can communicate, you know, it sort of opens it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, but of course. But I mean, you touch on that. But, you know, we've had humans longer than we've had language, right? I mean, I forget the figures, but, you know, if you take the humans as a line, language is only up the far end. So quite clearly, what were humans were relating to each other, presumably quite satisfactorily, at some level, with emotion but without language. So it can be done.
Thank you for your time. This was wonderful.
Thank you.
Yorick Wilkes is a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of Sheffield in the UK and a researcher on the Companions Project. You can find out more about Yorick and the Companions Project, including links to a recent talk he gave at Harvard, at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/MediaBerkman. This week's Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with the help of the Center for Research on Computation and Society from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.